This is Vulnerability Matters from the Money Advice Trust. Hello, hello. Welcome back to Vulnerability Matters from the Money Advice Trust. I'm Chris Fitch. When we think about making services accessible, our minds often immediately leap to the physical, the visual, or the audio barriers that disabled people can experience. But cognitive accessibility, designing services that work for people with cognitive and learning disabilities, is just as important, but often overlooked. So in today's episode, we're putting that right by looking at one of design's very best kept secrets, the COGA guidance. Now, you may not have heard of COGA. However, for those who've encountered the W3C, Cognitive Accessibility Guidance, it's helped them transform the experience of digital and customer-facing services for potentially millions of people who otherwise would be vulnerable to exclusion. So I asked Lisa Seaman-Horwitz, Chair of the Cognitive and Learning Disabilities Accessibility Task Force, to tell us what cognitive accessibility means, to introduce the 8 design principles set out in the COGA guidance, and explain how, in the last decade, COGA has changed digital and non-digital design approaches. Lisa, welcome to Vulnerability Matters. It's absolutely fantastic to have you here. Now, you're one of my heroines. I hope that doesn't embarrass you. Before we get into the whole COGA guidance, can we hear a bit about you, your background, and what first led you to focus on accessibility and design?
Oh, firstly, thanks for having me. I think you're doing great stuff here. So I have an engineering background, but I'm also heavily dyslexic and have some language communication disabilities. I was making some online tools for adults with specific learning disabilities, and StudyWeb, who were a big homework site at the time, they contacted me and asked me to give them some guidance to make their content more usable by dyslexics. And I thought that was really interesting, and I didn't have the answers, so I ended up writing to the Web Accessibility Initiative, the guys who make WCAG, or WCAG, and asked them. And they wrote back and said, well, actually, it's something we want to work on more, and you sound like the right kind of profile. So would you like to get involved or write a position paper or something like that? So I kind of pivoted direction and went there instead.
So you've got this background. You've been doing some incredible work with COGA and the W3C Cognitive and Learning Disabilities Accessibility Task Force. That's a mouthful. Some people listening, and I think this is one of the reasons having you on, won't have heard of COGA. So I wonder if you could just share the story behind COGA, its creation, and what problems it set out to solve.
Well, the main problem was the guidelines focused on other groups, like screen reader users. It's fantastic that they're included, but it was very hard to get them extended to include people with learning and cognitive disabilities, partly because of their own success. So many legislations refer to them, and that can make it very complicated to widen the scope or thing like this. So this COGA was a safe place for us to do the background research. Also, I think one of the other problems is people with learning cognitive disabilities are not well organized in well-funded lobbies and things like that. People often blame themselves. From our user groups, people often blame themselves when they can't use something. But that's kind of the bit of a problem.
So it was bringing together an area which had been overlooked for a number of reasons. And you were certainly not alone. There are others working with you, but you've been at the spearhead of this. But it was really about bringing attention to the cognitive and learning disability side. And COGA, since maybe 2015, I mean, it's produced a range of, I think, absolutely invaluable resources to reset that balance, to get more attention
on the cognitive and learning disability side. And I'll just reel some off. The cognitive accessibility guidance, the cognitive accessibility user research, the document making content usable for people with cognitive and learning disabilities, and, deep breath, the cognitive accessibility issue papers. Now, there's a wealth of material here. So I was wondering if you could explain two things. First, how the cognitive accessibility guidance, which we're going to focus on today, fits into this broader ecosystem, this kind of COGA universe, a bit like Marvel and DC, a COGA universe. And second, how does this sit alongside or relate to the wider WCAG guidance? What's its relationship?
We're part of WorkAG. We're a task force with two parent working groups, one of which is AG, the Accessibility Guidelines Group, who make WorkAG. And we publish Making Content Usable as a supplement to WorkAG. So that's how we fit together. In our process, we first do user research and do an analysis and literary review. And that we often publish as issue papers or modules of the issue papers. And we do that ongoing. Currently, we're working on a bunch of new issue papers, one on safety online, supported decision making. We've increased our scope to include mental health. Mental health has a big impact on cognitive function, so there's huge overlap. Indoor navigation systems and speech interfaces, which are becoming more and more important, like Alexa or phone menus. So there, the whole speech and auditory discrimination, auditory memory becomes a problem. And then from there, we can take guidance, what to do, if you like, for web designers. And that goes into the cognitive guidance, which is currently called Making Content Usable for People with Learning Cognitive Disabilities. And that's what we publish under WorkAG.
What I really, really love about the COGA work is how transparent it is. Everything's available for free. It's all online. You can see from the very outset of the project, things evolving in terms of the scope of the work and the focus. Yeah. So the cognitive accessibility guidance, which we mentioned, is we're going to have a look at that today. Now, it's built around eight core guidelines, and each one addresses a different aspect of cognitive accessibility. So rather than trying to cram them all in and cover them in depth, I wonder whether you could briefly list what the eight guidelines are, and then we'll focus on four bits of guidance just to give everybody a flavour of what's in there.
Sure. Well, the first objective, if you like, is helping users understand what things are and how to use them. So what's a button? You know, what page am I on? That kind of thing. The second objective is really about findability. Helping users find what they need on the site, on the page, for the critical functions. Objective three is about words, really. Use clear and understandable content. Long words can really be a barrier. And if you just start with a clear, common words on labels, headings, that can increase who can use your content straight away. Objective four is helping users avoid mistakes and correct mistakes. We'll still make some mistakes, but help us correct them as well. Helping users focus and avoid distraction and restore content after we inevitably sometimes will get distracted. ensuring processes do not rely on memory, like long passwords. Providing help and support. And if there's one thing that you can do, and you've only got time, you've only got a week or an afternoon or whatever it is, make sure people can get help if the site or the app is failing them. It could be an email or phone number, but just giving people a phone number that takes them to a menu system that they can't navigate isn't going to help. So does that really work? Test that. Test getting help. But there are other forms of support, like, your instruction videos, if those are useful, or an infographic. So supporting that important information that people need. Objective eight, support adaptation and personalization. And that's kind of good coding practice.
Absolutely. And there's a wealth of detail underneath those, and then that whole universe and ecosphere that we mentioned before. But let's drill down. Let's go right back to the start with guideline one, just to give people a flavor. So guideline one is helping users understand what things are and how to use them. And this can be a particular barrier to people who might be experiencing some form of cognitive impairment or living with a learning disability. So Lisa, can you give us a sense of what might be in that guideline and how it might look in practice?
Sure. It works on different levels. The site, do I know what site I'm on? Do I know what page I'm on? And a good page heading that says, you know, making an appointment for Dr. Meltz, that's going to remind you what page you're on, you know? On the page, you've got different buttons, different regions. What are they? What's a button? So sometimes it's just keeping that design simple, that these critical functions look like a button. It's really that simple. That and a good heading can help you know where you are and what you're doing.
Achieving that simplicity can be really difficult, particularly where a customer might be dealing with like quite complex choices and unfamiliar terminology. And what I love about the COGA guidance is it gives you that kind of destination to get to, help users understand what things are and how to use them, but then provides kind of a series of ways to actually get there. And it looks very simple when you read it on the page, the COGA guidance, but a lot of work has gone into putting that into place. So let's dive into guideline four, just to give people another flavor, which is to help users avoid mistakes and provide ways to recover when they do. Why was this one so important for people with cognitive and learning disabilities?
Well, we're more likely to make mistakes. That's the first thing, right? I don't have a visual memory, so copying my credit card number is likely to go wrong. But then when you make a mistake and you have to redo it and go back, you get more and more tired and frustrated. And that also impacts cognitive function, makes it worse. So the more you make mistakes, the more mistakes you're likely to make. And actually, at the end, it becomes obviously impossible. You're not going to manage. So it's really important, reducing that cognitive load and cognitive burden. And some good design will fix that. So back to the credit card example, if you have those four boxes to put in your credit card number, it's much easier to copy four numbers than the full 16 or however many there are. I think it does help everyone. Mm. But then there's also the fixing mistakes, that if someone does make a mistake, you want it to be easy to go back and make that correction without having to redo everything that you did right. And that minimizes the cognitive burden from the mistake. It can also just be you tap the wrong thing, that you tap something and now you're in the wrong place and you want to go back. But does that back function work? Or does it take you somewhere else and then you just go back to the home page or you give up?
But it's amazing how many forms and journeys are poorly designed still and on major retailers. The two guidelines we mentioned already and the two to come are really, really important. But one of the things that really makes COGA stand out and so engaging is the use of user stories and personas, which are weaved throughout them. We've got Alison, an older user with mild cognitive impairment, Amy, a scientist with autism, George, a supermarket worker with Down syndrome. Can you tell us a bit more about how these user stories sit within COGA and how they came about?
Well, they help people understand the guidance. So we've mapped everything, the same objectives with these patterns of what to do. They map to user stories and those map to these personas, you know, who it is, it's George, right? And they help you understand the context and that these people are actually in your target audience. And actually, you know them, the school friend with ADD or dyslexia, and suddenly it all clicks into place. Or your uncle who doesn't remember things as well as he used to, but needs help with his banking app. And that is actually a lack of autonomy if he needs help. So we're trying to help people think it through and put these personas in early research and these user needs, if they're user need driven, into their research stage as well, and shaping their solutions, as well as testing. And we're actually expanding it. So we're going to have one, I think, on that addresses some of the issues with mood disorder and cognitive function, like probably anxiety related disability. Second language English speakers, like immigrants. And also cognitive function is impacted by a lot of health situations, like chemo brain. If anyone's done chemo, they'll recognize that. Even pregnancy, long COVID. These are all good times to have easy access to healthcare and be able to fix a water leak.
There's a common challenge and a common harm there, regardless of the driver or the condition or circumstance. That the last two guidelines we're just going to just go through briefly are guideline 5, which is help users focus and avoid distractions. Now, this feels like a challenge for anyone in the world that we live in today. There are lots of distractions out there, particularly in design. But what's an example of this being done well or perhaps poorly, Lisa?
Oh, poorly is easier sometimes, right? Overlays, the extra special offers that you'll get given, and then you've forgotten what the hell you were trying to do, or by that time you've panicked. So a clean design knows what journey it's taking you on, and that's what it's doing. But the other side of that guidance is to help orientate people if they do get distracted and help restore their context. So you come back to the task and you know where you are and what you're doing. Because difficulty of focusing, it's not just people, you know, the school kid with ADHD. It could be an anxiety disorder. It could be situational, just lots of stuff going on. It could be age-related, such as like an early stage pre-dementia kind of MCI. In these cases, memory can also be affected. So someone gets distracted, it could not even be your fault, it could be someone walking in the room distracts them. And then will they know what's going on when they sit back down and trying to focus? Do they know what they're doing? And again, just like the first guideline, can be solved with this good page heading, making doctor's appointment. And you know, sometimes what happens if we don't take care of this is people think they've made the dentist appointment and they haven't, because they got distracted before the end. So they remember doing it, but they didn't know that they hadn't finished it.
And this takes us into that last guideline, which is personalization and support adaptation. Now, this is a really key principle for accessibility, both cognitive and learning disability, but more generally. What should firms be thinking about here?
Well, firstly, there's a lot of new standards. The ADAPT actually came off one of our issue papers, the ADAPT Task Force. They're making more semantics to support accessibility. But it's really people's assistive technology. People will find a browser extension or spell checker installed, and now there's the new AI summaries or symbolization, and they've found these things that work for them and create an environment that works for them.
No, absolutely. Listen, the COGA guidance, I think, has been useful to far more many people than those just working on digital journeys alone. I speak to people who work in communications, that work in customer service, who've had a look at them and taken away lots of valuable insights, data, material. So thank you so much for doing it. But if you had to leave our audience with one last clear message about designing for cognitive accessibility, what would it be?
Well, you said it overlaps with usability, really. It helps a lot of people. that things that are difficult for many people, they can be a wall, like a brick wall, a complete block for people with cognitive or learning disabilities. And that's when it becomes an accessibility issue. So, for instance, lots of people hate those long passwords that change every 3 months and they wish you didn't do that or there was an alternative. But if someone has an impaired short-term working memory, then it's a complete block and they have to ask someone else for help to log in to your site. So that's really what it's about. It's about allowing people to do things independently, and it saves so much in, well, frustration, but also resources for us as a community, that people can access things without and do things themselves independently.
Yeah, design for autonomy. Lisa, thank you so much for your time, and please come back again to tell us about the work.
And that was Lisa Seaman-Horwitz, helping us understand what cognitive accessibility is, why it matters, and how the COGA guidance can help essential services meet the needs of customers with cognitive and learning disabilities. If you want to learn more, train your Google search at COGA guidance. It's free, it's full of practical ideas and personas, and it will change your design practice and thinking, trust me. And that's it for this episode of Vulnerability Matters. So until next time, fix up, look sharp, and keep on remembering that vulnerability matters. Vulnerability Matters was produced by Mandy McGreevy and Phil King and brought to you by the Money Advice Trust.